Warning, do not listen to this podcast if hearing about freedom and liberty is not legal for you in your community. And if so, you should immediately move to a hipper community.
Welcome to the Freedom Fiends Podcast, a weekly web lab where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati cover the punk rockinist, hip-hopinist current events, as well as timeless universal truths about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because there's no such thing as half-free. The Freedom Fiends Podcast, available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com.
Rolling. Freedom Fiends!
Freedom Fiends, y'all. So today is 2 years since DJ and I have lived in Wyoming.
Nice, it's the anniversary, huh?
Yes, it is.
How do you feel 2 years later after making the big move? The move for freedom, as you said on TV before.
A lot better than I did then. That I remember the running joke is the recurring, is DJ saying, I am so tired. Because when she got here and the next day after she'd slept 2 hours, she was more tired than she's ever been, she said, because we moved ourselves. We basically, we hired moving people on each end, but we got a big truck and she drove it.
Without none of your stuff in it? She just like drove
all of our stuff in it.
Okay.
We hired two moving guys in California. They packed up the truck.
Right.
And
right.
Then she drove it here. We spent two nights in hotels.
Was it a U-Haul? What was it? A Pence?
It was a giant U-Haul. It was like a 28-foot U-Haul.
Yeah.
Which was way bigger than we needed. We filled it half up, but we thought we had more, you know.
Driving a U-Haul cross-country just sucks. Me and the wife did it, you know, from Texas to Washington State, and it was just horrible. We got like 7 miles a gallon, you know, had to stop every couple hours to gas up. Spent so much money on gas, and
we stayed in two hotels, one in Evanston, one right when you leave Utah to come in Wyoming.
Evanston, Wyoming.
Yeah, and then we stayed somewhere in Utah, and it was like, we had to get hotels that would take pets and smokers, and the hotels that will take pets and smokers and park a truck are not nice hotels.
Right, oh yeah, they're the seedy ones.
They're dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I imagine you were protected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But didn't sleep well, because we were protecting ourselves, but we also had to like keep looking out to make sure no one was breaking in and stealing everything we owned.
Yeah, I mean, what we did is we parked the U-Haul, you know, right outside the window of wherever we were staying.
We couldn't do that at one of the places.
Ah, bummer. In fact, that was one of the experiences that I think got my wife used to the idea of thinking about the gun as a means of protection. Yeah. It was that and then the wedding night, because we opened all our wedding presents and, you know, we got stacks of cash, like thousands of dollars. And she was like, did you bring your gun? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, thank God. Because we were in a seedy hotel, too, on our wedding night.
So your wedding night made you think of guns.
Well, the wedding night, she was happy that we had a gun there to protect us and our wedding bounty, I guess. So, yeah, and then, of course, the U-Haul trip definitely reinforced that. And now whenever we're walking, you know, and she sees some seedy people, she's like, you got your gun on you? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, good.
Yeah. So we're calling this episode Guns and Weed Under the Stars, because tomorrow night, Friday night, the 8th of July, the New Jersey Libertarian Party is doing an event showing our movie called Guns and Weed Under the Stars.
Under the Stars. So is it going to be like in a drive-through or in a park? I'm guessing in a park.
Private property.
Private property, even better.
It's libertarian, man. It's got to be private property.
That is awesome. Yeah, I guess a park wouldn't show it, would they?
Speaking of private property, I saw three interesting movies and I have a book review of a book I actually read this week.
Right, I actually read your review. Very astute. I enjoyed reading the review.
I'm going to have you read it in your newscaster voice.
Okay, it's kind of long. Maybe we can popcorn read. Do you remember that from grade school?
No, public back school and things. Forth?
Yeah, what yeah. You read until you yell popcorn, or somebody randomly yells popcorn. There's variations.
Well, how about we'll each do a paragraph back and forth. I don't know if I indented it well in paragraphs.
Yeah. But we could do it the hip-hop way. Yep. I'll get a verse, you get a verse.
That's how we used to read in AA. Sometimes when we did book readings in AA of the AA book, sometimes each person would read a page. But sometimes in NA meetings, people aren't as well educated, because there's a lot more street people that never got educations because drugs are illegal and alcohol's not, and drugs force them out into, you know,
life on the streets.
Crime and life on the streets. Right. So in NA meetings, we'd each have each person read one paragraph.
Yeah, because shorter attention spans, less short-term memory kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Just really not a lot of literacy. I've been in a lot of meetings where people called it narcotics anonymous. Like they couldn't say the word anonymous.
Right. I can
so
see that.
So your wife works for a, what kind of college? Is it a private college or a
college? It's like one of those schools that have the commercials that run telling you, you know, you can have a career. And
right. I saw a documentary about those that's really good. It's a Frontline documentary.
Oh, I'd
TV
love to
show.
See that. Frontline is quality journalism usually.
Yeah. Which is why Chappelle always parodies them. But right. It's called College Inc. College, yep. INC.
Yeah.
It's a great documentary. It's kind of an expose, but it also, to me, makes me think, like, that's how to do education. It's really, you know, there's all these private colleges that are accredited that have come up now, like University of Phoenix, ITT Tech, things right. like that. You know, mostly they teach you to do three things. They teach you to be a nurse, an IT computer guy, or a cop. But, you know, they actually teach people to get jobs, which liberal arts college does not do.
Correct, yeah.
And they're generally more expensive than community college, almost as expensive as state colleges. But, and this is my problem with them, is they get everybody to get financial aid from the government.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that you look at, and there's some really good market-driven things behind it, but there's also a big government paw on it. You know, and the accreditation thing, there's often, you know, bureaucratic silliness that they have to go through in that respect. Like, I know recently there's been laws that keep them from offering incentives for referring students. So they used to, you know, give you, you know, an extra $100 if you drag your friends along and get them to get into school. They can't do that anymore. So all the schools have to do, you know, workarounds and loopholes by giving out gift certificates. And of course, everybody always finds a way around all sorts of silly regulations. It just requires a lot extra work and resources that could be used to make the product better or the company better.
What the financiers who create these colleges often do is they'll find a failing college, a failing private college that has accreditation, and then buy them basically because they have the accreditation, and then make them into a private college.
Right.
You know, I think in a libertarian paradise, this is how schooling would be done in LibPair, you know. And a lot of them do cheaper online courses too.
Right. In some ways, I mean, I think there are aspects of it that I could see in a libertarian paradise, but that last bit you said, I think you'd see more of the sort of online learning or even apprenticeships and more small scale stuff. A lot of times when I see these, I guess what you'd call the kind of colleges you'd see in a documentary like Education Inc. or whatever the Frontline special was, they're almost like factory schooling. Like, you know, people talk about factory farms. These are almost like factory schooling. They have a whole fleet of people who are their admissions reps, and it's their whole job to just sign up as many people as they can and call people.
Yeah, that was one of the critiques of it. Another one is that they overpromise employability.
Yeah,
and the Obama administration actually tried to get something passed to where, like, if you didn't get a job, they had to give you all your money back, which I think is taking it too far.
Taking it way far. Well, and I know one thing that they did pass is the schools now have to put a warning, you know, in the same vein as the warning on a pack of cigarettes. They have to put that on their literature now, a little bar saying, please go to our website for graduation rates, because you have to let them know your graduation rates and your job getting rates. I mean, I don't know what they call it, but the rates of people who actually get a job is now a government mandated warning you have to put on your literature.
They're going to start putting pictures of, like, cancerous lungs on cigarettes. Maybe they should start putting pictures of, like,
broke-ass college students.
Unemployed college students.
Working at Blockbuster.
Getting sold to corporations as sex slaves. But what was that called? Somebody's debt? Rachel's debt?
Yeah.
Emily's debt.
Emily's debt. Yeah. Sexy.
But an interesting thing, like, the Obama administration is coming at them from two angles. One is, you know, trying to push them down. But at the same time, they're actually, they interviewed the Secretary of Education in this documentary, and they're actually kind of letting them thrive. And the only reason they're doing that,
to accumulate the debt.
No.
No?
Because Obama promised, like, school for everybody. And these colleges are the only way that that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right, because anybody can get in. I mean, most of these colleges have programs. I forget the acronym, because, you know, all these things are just heavily acronymed. But there's some acronym they have for basically the kids that, you know, are so not
dumb.
I don't want to say that, but basically the one
not prepared.
The ones that you have to teach 1+1. The ones you have to teach the super basic skills. The ones that are as literate as the people at the NA meeting.
As some of the people at the NA meeting.
Right, and they actively target these kind of people and make sure they can get in, because that's the thing. You get as many people in as you can. That's the whole point. It's basically driven by that. And Yeah, and they all go to financial aid. They all get money. It's almost like a big government money laundering machine in some
What's
ways.
What's the acronym?
I don't remember. It's something obscure.
You know what PEBCAC is? PEBCAK? It's a computer help desk acronym for problem exists between chair and keyboard. They'll say, you got a PEBCAC on line one. It's basically the user is the problem. The mechanics say it too. The problem is the nut behind the wheel.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha. No, but I was looking up the acronym for this program. It's called. I think it's called Ability to Benefit. And that's the program that these colleges have with people that are – that's the way of saying it nicely. They have an ability to benefit by not being so dumb.
There's actually a lot of them target recovering drug addicts and people just out of prison and you know, ex-prostitutes. And there's also a weird kind of social justice component to some of them. One of the guys they interviewed works with the Dream Center in Los Angeles, which is this weird – like I used to run into – it's a mega church that was really close to my house, and they're involved in all sorts of, I don't know about Acorn, but Acorn-like activities of taking taxpayer money and mixing it with church in a secular way getting funding. And it was weird. Like, there used to be these guys that would come around, you know, in like orange jumpsuits or orange reflective vests and clean my street. And I'd go out and talk to them, and they all looked like ex-con, you know, an ex-junkie can spot an ex-junkie a mile away.
Yeah.
And I'd go out and talk to them and be like, so does the city pay you? And they're like, no, we do this for free. We're from the Dream Center. I'm like, really? And I'm like,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
cool. All right.
It's almost just another piece in the prison industrial complex. You know, it's the nonprofit church recovering drug addict complex.
There's the recovery industrial complex too, which I have a lot to say about, you know, because basically, like, as much as I can complain about AA and NA, they're free. You know, you can put a dollar in the cup for coffee, but you don't have to. And they're literally free. And it's like there's a whole recovery industry of books and seminars and facilities that have come up that have basically taken the free thing and put a price tag on it. And a lot of it's connected with government.
Right, right.
So moving right along, the second documentary I saw was called – it's okay, this is the only documentary I've ever seen that has – old classic rockers like Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, along with like rappers and hip hop people like Money Mark, Master Mike, DJ Logic, and DJ Spooky. You know those people?
DJ Spooky, I've heard of. The others,
you don't know Money Mark?
Money Mark? No.
Money Mark's the keyboard player for the Beastie Boys.
Ah, huh.
Okay, so the documentary is called Moog. It's about Robert Moog, the inventor of the Moog synthesizer.
Okay, yeah, yeah, I know about that.
And it's pronounced Moog, not Moog. He pronounces it in there. He says it rhymes with Vogue. It doesn't sound like a cow going moo plus G. It's Moog.
I always called it Moog.
It's Moog. Rhymes with Vogue.
Learn something new every day.
Really good documentary. He died a few years ago as an old man, a rich old man. And, you know, he basically invented electronic music. Or, you know, popularized it, put one in every garage, as they say. You know, Ford didn't invent the car. He put one in every barn.
Right. So he's the Henry Ford of the synthesizer, basically.
Yeah. And he also, this is where it ties in with what you do, he also co-invented the first synthesizer module for a computer, you know, software version of a synthesizer.
The first soft synth?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that either.
Which was a plug-in for Pro Tools.
Right.
He's an amazing guy. It's a good documentary. He's really kind of like a agnostic spiritualist in a really cool way. Like a lot of what he talks about is engineering, but then he talks a lot about like the community of man through music and how the world's connected and how people think and what the future is and really cool. And then like he'd be like talking about his organic garden while he's doing it.
Okay.
It's a really nice documentary. It's on all these are on Netflix.
So yeah, it's sort of a holistic approach to the whole thing in his philosophy, which I think is good. I mean, I think things are connected and too often we compartmentalize things, and that's part of how we get divided and then we lose focus. And I think that's part of why the world's so effed up, is we're all going in a million different directions, fighting a million different battles, but it's almost just the one battle.
Worms. So his first product came out the year I was born, 64.
Okay.
And this is something you probably don't remember much of. I remember the tail end of it. He was hated by musicians. Because a lot of musicians, a lot of conventional and classical musicians and session musicians, because they said he was going to put them out of work. The first interview he did was with some acoustic science magazine, and their first question was, do you feel guilty for what you've done?
Mm.
The musicians union, like band synthesizers, of course they did, you know, they're a union.
I guess what I don't understand about that, you know, being a young dude is, I mean, the first synthesizer, it was just another instrument. I mean, right? I mean, it was electronic, yeah, but you still had to play it. It didn't play itself. You still had to have a musician behind it to make it sound good.
Right. Well, I remember the band Queen, who I was always a fan of, you know, on their first, like, five or six records, when they'd put the credits, like, you know, Brian May, guitar, Freddie Mercury, vocals, piano, etc., it would list all four of them and what they played, and then it would say, and nobody played synthesizer, which was less a dig on synthesizers and more they were getting synthesizer-like sounds out of an electric guitar. But but then on one record, they, you know, the one with Another One Bites the Dust, it had synthesizers and they went disco.
Yeah, yeah.
But
synths sound great. I mean, I think the synth was an amazing invention, and I think it's great to have sound that's almost or literally infinitely customizable. I think it's a giant leap forward.
Yeah, but it was really pushed back against. You know, people hated it, and they thought that this guy was the devil. You know, kind of like the way some rock fans look at rap music, like, oh, that's just a bunch of noise, or even worse, like, oh, that's indicative of the decay of Western civilization. That's how they looked at the Moog.
Well, people do. I mean, people who are established in a certain status quo always do that kind of thing. I mean, I'm sure people who built the buggies that horses drew hated Henry Ford, to go back to that analogy.
People who made the whips complained about him.
Anybody in the industry. Whenever something new comes along, the people who are established are always going to complain because they don't want the boat to be rocked. They don't want to lose their good footing.
And that's one of the biggest problems with the war on drugs, is there's so many people that make money off it.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, in a lot of these legalization campaigns, especially for marijuana, people talk about all the money the taxpayers would save. But the thing is, that doesn't convince the politicians or the bureaucrats, because that's money that they get from the taxpayers. So that's not going to win them over.
I think the only way pot's going to end up legal is economically. It's going to be taxed, and, you know, instead of having the cop lobby and the prison lobby, they're going to have to make more money from the pot lobby.
Yeah. I mean, the only way the cops would ever go for that, and maybe this is a strategy thing, is just promise all the taxes will go to cops, so it'll supplement all the money they get anyway. Promise all the money will go to cops and lawyers and judges, and then it'll be legalized.
Have you ever met a member of the Musicians Union?
Have I ever met a member of the Musicians Union? No, I can't say that I have.
When I was a kid, it was an actual thing. Like, you know, bands would try to get in the Musicians Union so they could play Union Hall, play dances. You know?
I remember in Austin, when I lived in Austin, you know, there was a bunch of flyers and everything saying if you're a musician, you can get insurance. You know, it was.
Yeah, I remember when they tried to go after the hipsters when they were losing members.
They tried to go after the hipsters?
Yeah.
How so?
Putting up those flyers.
Okay. Yeah.
It was about 10 years ago, right?
Yeah. Nah. Yeah. About 6 years. Yeah. 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 Same
age. So they're still doing it. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, the only member of the Musicians Union I've ever met is Michael Urbano, the guy that played drums in my band Slish, who, you know, plays with Sheryl Crow. And
as like a session dude or as like a live dude?
He'd go do, like, play tambourine on somebody else's record and get paid, you know, union minimum for 3 hours, which worked out to, I don't know, $600 or something.
Hmm. Okay.
Even if he's only there for 45 minutes.
To play some tambourine?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. That's pimp.
Yep. He's a killer tambourine player, though, man. And, you know, it's actually a harder thing to play well than you think. And really, like, tambourine can make or break a hit.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. I mean, yeah, it can be a very expressive thing or a very basic thing, depending on how you rock it. I could see that.
Well, when it's done right, too, it's often just in the pocket and on the chorus only. But it really just makes you tap your toe that much more when it comes to the chorus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's jingly and upbeat. And fast, it makes you want to move.
So the third and final movie I have a quick review of is The Story of Anvil.
Anvil.
Anvil, yeah. Anvil is a heavy metal band that's been together for 30 years. When they first started, they toured with, like, AC/DC and Metallica and Slayer and Megadeth, and were considered on the same track to stardom that those bands were. And, like, people in those bands loved them and, you know, considered them contemporaries or even influences. And they just never made it. And they're all working day jobs in Toronto, Ontario. And this documentary followed them at age 50, you know, trying to make it.
They're still going at it then.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, if they're still playing stuff that sounds like from that era, then I can tell why they're not making it big, right?
Well, there are people who like that stuff. And in the movie, they go do a tour of Europe. And even though it was all real, it kind of half reminded me of Spinal Tap. And then it kind of half reminded me of my experiences with my band Bomb. I mean, scenes were like, they're playing to a good crowd one night, and the next night they're playing to five people, and there's like no flyers up, and they're screaming at the promoter who doesn't speak English, and then they're screaming at each other in the capitals of Europe, and that just reminded me of my sad times with my band.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wasn't 50.
Right.
I was 27.
Difference. Yeah.
I was your age.
But it's a good movie, and it's got redemption in the third act. And they've actually, since the movie came out, they've become a lot more popular, and they're touring a lot and playing packed houses.
Really? So the movie kind of gave them a bump. That's good. That's good.
Yep.
Maybe that's all they needed. Maybe they should have put out a movie from the very beginning.
I know. So we're done with our punk rock Siskel and Ebert. Moving on to cheap beer, Nima Vidati.
Cheap beer. I was going to say that's one of the things I've noticed since this great recession we've been in, at least in the past few months. It all started when I moved to Washington and noticed there was this beer at Walgreens, exclusively there, called Big Flats. It's $2.99 for a six-pack. So we do the math. That's 50 cents a beer. You can't beat it. Wow. It tastes delicious, too. I mean, it's not, you know, Sam Adams, but it's easily on par with, say, Miller Lite or Busch. You know, in between Busch and Miller Lite, maybe somewhere like that. For 50 cents a can. We go to the store and buy, you know, not a pallet, but, you know, 4 six-packs on a little wooden crate all the time. Easy to do. And then just now we went to, there's this cheesesteak chain around town called Brew Cheese, and we went there for lunch. They have 99-cent draft beer that they make themselves. It's their own beer. They're not a brewery. You know, they don't have a brew thing there, but it's just this beer that I don't know if they had it commissioned, but 99 cents at a restaurant for a beer.
That's almost like LibPair prices, you know?
It really is. And
it's like without the taxes and the regulation, it's about what beer would cost.
Right, and I love it. It's not something I've ever seen until recently as far as, you know, beer that's just targeted at people who want to drink but are going through hard times, which is, you know, something I'd imagine happens in a depression is beer usage.
Which is everybody.
Goes up. And
let's quit calling it a recession. It's almost a depression. For a lot of people,
well, I was thinking about that. I was pondering that during the little bathroom break and wondering, you know, should I start calling it a depression? What do you think? Your call is for depression, huh?
I don't know. Are you depressed? I'm not.
I'm not really depressed.
We're both working.
I think we're on the edge of the depression, and I don't think it's a double dip. You know, all the mainstream folks are going to call this, oh, we're headed to in this scary double dip recession. I never saw the rise. It seems like we fell off, and we've sort of been stuck in this funk. And I mean, I think a depression may be on the way, but I'm not going to call it a double dip.
Okay. Do you know how cheap pot would be in LibPair?
How cheap pot would be? I don't know. I mean, that's the thing is it's almost impossible to really tell because...
It'd be like as expensive as corn, man.
As cheap as corn?
Maybe, nah, probably more like catnip, you know?
Yeah, or an herb, you know, maybe basil or something like
they
that.
They call it peep nip.
Well, I mean, I think you remember when we were down in Colorado shooting the dispensary, how it was so much cheaper than, you know, the street market. And I've been hearing from a friend who's actually going to go start running a dispensary in Colorado. And he was saying, yeah, the prices have just been, the bottom's been falling.
Yeah, but
out
it's still,
it.
It's still $320 an ounce, which is cheap for good weed. But in LibPair, I think it'd be $30 for an ounce.
Yeah. I think in LibPair, you'd be buying it at a farmer's market, be organic.
Yeah.
You'd be buying, you know.
You'd buy a bushel.
You'd buy a bushel, yeah. It wouldn't even be bagged up. You'd just take it home, you know, in a bushel.
Well, you know, think about what like cocoa leaves or, you know, raw opium costs in Afghanistan or Peru.
I don't know. I've never bought raw cocoa leaves in Peru.
It's like $20 a kilogram or something for raw opium base.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a goat. It's right. Less than an AK.
Okay. That's good.
You know, which is something I wanted to talk about was there's this video out now of that American-born Al-Qaeda guy. I forget his name. I think he's from New Mexico that went over and lives in Afghanistan.
Right.
Or
the one the Obama administration claims the right to assassinate, even though he's a U.S. citizen.
Yeah. And he put out a YouTube video recently, or a video of him saying that he was telling American terrorist-friendly people to go to gun shows and buy guns without background checks so they could use them in terrorism. And, you know, he's like, you can get a full auto AK there. And I'm thinking, like, no, you can't. Well, you can with a permit, and it's $14,000. And it's like, there's something about that that screams false flag to me, because You can buy a full auto AK in Afghanistan literally for a goat. That's the price of an AK there for like, you know, right. $300. Right.
Yeah, they don't need our gun shows to help them arm themselves.
Yeah.
They have all and sorts of Soviet surplus left over from when they were battling the Soviets.
I think that guy's paid by, because they're trying to backpedal now with this Fast and Furious fiasco of the ATF letting guns walk, you know, when Mexican drug cartel people go into Phoenix gun stores and try to buy them. Instead of refusing the purchase, the gun store owners were told by the ATF to let the purchase happen.
Right.
And then they tried to track them, and there's no way to track them. And they, you know, ended up being used to kill Americans. And it's a congressional foo-for-all right now. John Stewart did a good thing on it. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
I loved his thing where the guy held up the redacted pages of the report the ATF gave the congressman. And, you know, the congressman's like, why are you even bothering to send us? There's page after page, and they were entirely black. And he's like, we used our Daily Show advanced optics software to remove the redaction. And it's like a middle finger pointing at this congressman.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, great stuff. I mean, I don't know. All the coverage I've been reading about it, I guess it kind of makes me feel weird because we really don't want to blame the inanimate object on the murder of somebody. I mean, that's kind of what we rail against all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the guns that killed these American agents. It was the cartels. I mean, if they didn't get these guns from this gunwalker program, they would have got them some other way. It's not like they have a shortage of guns as far as the cartels go. We've seen the pictures with the gold-plated guns and the AKs that are diamond-encrusted. They're not buying those from America, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the guns down there that the cartels are using are stolen or walked from the military.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think that. I know that.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yep. So, pooper scoopers.
Pooper scoopers.
Lebanon, New Hampshire, of all places. Here's the scoop. Some apartment complexes are using DNA testing on dog doo-doo to find out who's not cleaning up after their pets. And the apartment owner is requiring that all dog owners there provide a sample.
Yeah, a DNA sample.
Why not a camera, first of all?
Why not a camera? I mean, I guess somebody really wants to go play in the poop.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I can think of.
There's a picture of the lady who wants to play in the poop. Her name is Debbie Violette.
Right, and she's got the big grin on her face and the box of the home DNA.
DNA pet eye testing.
Yeah. She looks like she's ready to have a good old time.
She's a poop player.
Poop player. I mean, I read about this kind of thing about a year ago, but it was condos. And I guess I had a bigger beef then because it was more like the tyranny of a homeowners association, because a lot of the people owned their own condos and had lived there for years without this, and then they stuck it in and were now subject to it without, you know, voluntarily having to sign on to it. And they own their property because they live in a condo. Now, I guess this is an apartment, so it's kind of different.
Have I talked on here about me and DJ's experience with the homeowners association before we moved to Wyoming?
Well, are you on a homeowners association right now, or are you free?
Hell no.
Good.
We're free. Good. I mean, HOAs or homeowners association agreements are like another level of government.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a HOA, it's like you own your house, but you really don't. And the constitution of these things basically includes that they can change the law anytime.
Yeah.
And the people on the homeowners board tend to be little old ladies who want to tell people what to do, and gay men. For some reason, in California, it's always gay men. Which I noticed, too, that in Narcotics Anonymous in California, the people at the service level, there's a representative from each meeting, and they go to once a month and have, like, a congress to decide what to do regionally with NA. And a lot of them were gay men, too. And it's, like, nothing for or against gay men. It's just they like to get involved in nanny politics. Maybe they are a nanny, or maybe they feel nannied and want to fight back. I don't know. But gay men and old ladies, man.
But it's basically tyranny on a neighborhood level, no doubt.
Yeah, and here's what happened. I mean, basically, there's a drunk guy who may or may not be a criminal in California who, if I could find him, I'd buy him dinner and thank him. Because if it weren't for him, I'd probably still be in California. Someone tried to break into our house, and I called the police. They actually came. They caught him. And it was this old drunk Mexican dude who was trying to climb in the window, and he said he thought it was his house. I went out and confronted him with a stun gun and a phone in the other hand. I could have gotten killed, but he wasn't badass. He wasn't a career criminal. He was just a guy. I really think he thought it was his house because it turned out that there was a place, all the houses looked the same, and there was a place like eight houses over where there was a bunch of day laborers living in a house. So okay. I think he thought it was his place.
Yeah.
But it freaked us out so much that we bought our first gun, and then we wanted to put a light up, a motion sensor light, in the back of the house because it was like the only place that was dark.
Right. Like one of those floodlights that you walk by at night and they
yeah,
light up.
Yeah. Like all the other houses had really good lighting in back of them, but ours did not. So I went into the hardware store and bought a motion sensor light and then realized, oh, wait, we have to ask the HOA. And we wrote them an email. It took 9 months of threatening them wow. to get a light up.
Wow.
Of like threatening legal action and saying like, you know, if we're killed, it's your fault and our families are going to sue you.
So why didn't you just put it up? And I'm asking because I'm sure there's a good reason.
Because they would have taken it down.
Right.
Like our neighbors put out a beautiful flower garden on their property without asking permission. And the next day the HOA had the gardeners come and rip all their flowers out.
Right, right. In fact, I read about a case in Texas where a couple wanted to zero scape their yard, you know, because they didn't want to water. And the homeowners association freaked out and it actually went to court and there was a legal battle. And it took like 2 years and they had to spend thousands of dollars just to have their yard the way they wanted.
Yeah, there's all sorts of stories. There was one in Florida where, you know, there was a World War II vet who wanted to put up a flag on Flag Day and they ripped the flag down. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's private property. It's not. And one could argue, well, it's a voluntary agreement that you entered into when you bought the house. But it's a voluntary agreement that says it can change at any time and will,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. And I think there's something to be said about the busybody aspect of it, too. I mean, yeah, you voluntarily agree to it, but that doesn't change the fact that there are people who are spending their time and energy and efforts just terrorizing people because they want them to live how they want them to live.
Yeah. I mean, you could not play basketball in this housing pod of, you know, 300 units. You could not skateboard. Mm. You couldn't play loud music. I liked that you couldn't play loud music. That's something I would want in an HOA. I would agree to.
Which is weird of you because you're a musician. You know, if I lived in my own house, I would want to be playing loud music all the time.
But I'm a headphone musician.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that.
You know, when we were recording in my basement, making that loud ass hip hop rock and roll, did we ever once play it through speakers?
I mean, a couple times, I guess, to check on it, you know, to monitor.
Yeah.
But,
and actually, we could have played it loud because my house is brick and the basement. I mean, I've done a test where at 4 a.m, I had DJ go stand in the front yard and I stood in the basement and played loud electric guitar and screamed and sang at the top of my lungs and she could not hear it a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you could fire a gun in my house in the basement.
We won't go there.
I won't say anyone ever has, but you could. Yeah, home rifle range. Yeah, it's HOAs are just another level. It's, you know, federal, state, county, local, and HOA.
In neighborhood.
And who wants that kind of nanny?
I do not. Yeah, layers upon layers. It's the 7-layer dip of tyranny. I don't want any of.
Yes.
I don't want any part of it. I mean, obviously, I have to be subject to some of it, but as little as possible. Me and the wife want a homestead. I mean, we're saving up money right now, thinking about buying our home we're going to settle in, and we don't want to be – we don't even really want to live in a neighborhood. You know, we want to live out in the county somewhere on some land.
Check the regulations because some neighborhoods have something like an HOA, and it's not necessarily disclosed when you buy land or buy a house.
Right.
You know?
That's why I'm saying we don't want to live in a neighborhood. We want to live unencumbered.
Yeah.
If
you want to live out in the sticks. You know, in Wyoming, you could live out in the sticks and do anything you want on your land, but you could live in the county – where it feels like the sticks and you can't do anything you want to, as we have covered over and over.
As we've seen, yeah, in Natrona County. Yeah. I guess that's the catch. You got to live in a county that's not a part of the same county as a bigger city is in, like Casper
yeah.
and Natrona, where basically the commissioners and the city council members, you know, work together a lot. So a lot of the same ideas and a lot of the same tyranny gets shared back and forth.
So you've been having a reoccurring dream where bullets don't kill?
Yeah, I've noticed that. It sort of started, if you remember, when I first decided to buy my own gun. It became a thing. I needed to get a handgun. I covered a story about, you know, a guy that got shot in the parking lot of his own home. You know, he walked out. There were some bad dudes, and they capped him. And ever since then, I've sort of had these dreams where I pull out my gun, I'm being attacked, and I fire away, but the bullets don't hurt the person. And they keep coming at me. Why I bring this up is last night, it was so bad that I pulled out the Mosin after the 9mm wasn't working, pulled out the Mosin, shot the Mosin, which if you know what Mosin Nagant, it's an old Russian rifle, big rounds, you know, they're bigger than the AK rounds. It's basically a 30 caliber round, huge. Shot the dude right in the chin and it just stuck there, And he like looked at me all pissed off. I'm like, wow, Mosinbul. And then somehow in my head, you know, because the way dreams do it, sort of morphed into where it was one of these A2 rifles. Have you seen the YouTubes of the dudes trying to shoot these? It's the
500 Tyrannosaurus
round. 500 Tyrannosaur round, which the guy, Art Alpin, who makes it, actually does it there in Wyoming. They moved their factory there. I've visited it. But basically, it's this huge round. That, you know, they used to shoot elephants. It just will sink right into an elephant and, like, lodge itself into the brain past the thick skin and bones. And eventually I tried that on this guy, and to no avail. So I don't know really what it means, but...
I think I know what it means, because I have dreams sometimes where I'm in a life-threatening situation and have to defend myself with a gun, and my gun jams. There's something wrong with
okay,
it.
Okay.
It's basically just the grown-up version of the being naked at school
dream. The being unprepared. Yeah, because when I was in college, it took the form of, you know, being at the end of the semester, and I just forgot to go to math class. Like, I just never went. Just decided not to go, and then at the end, I'm like, oh, shit, there was that other class I had to go to.
Yeah, I used to have a recurring dream from my boarding school for a few years after I finished there where, like, basically I got kicked out of that school between 11th and 12th grade and ended up going to college to get my high school diploma. But in this dream, I'm still there in 12th grade, and it's the end of the year, and it's like 2 weeks before graduation, and I just split. I leave the school, and I don't graduate.
Yeah. I guess it's the feeling, the dreams are related to, you know, the feeling of being ineffective or the fear of failure kind of thing.
Well, I think that the gun grabbers would certainly have a field day with your dream and my dream about guns, but really, I think that whenever people have dreams of any kind of failure, I think it's healthy, and it's processing things from your daily life and winning at things where you feel a sense of inadequacy. I mean, I think the government makes people feel inadequate in a lot of ways. Right. I mean, you're just constantly tyrannized. I don't have SWAT dreams or anything, yeah. But I'm surprised I don't.
Right, right. Well, they want us to live in fear, and they want us to be want us to be ineffectual, because the more ineffectual you are, the more you have to rely on, you know, a higher power to help you along. They want to be that higher power in every regard.
Right.
Which is scary, and maybe that's another reason for the dream is that feeling of being ineffective or not being able to defend myself. They would love that. They're probably pumping that dream into me from some secret substation.
They're beaming it. So speaking of the government not getting its way, Casey Anthony.
Yeah, crazy. I mean, honestly, everybody's calling it like the new OJ, but I really had not read about it at all until the day that
it's not the new OJ, man. Okay. OJ was OJ.
It was groundbreaking to me when that I was in bizarre. Like fifth grade. But this Casey Anthony thing, like all of a sudden, just every comment on Facebook was about Casey Anthony, and I'm like, I didn't even know what the hell this thing was.
It's not the new OJ, man. OJ was the hero to millions of Americans. You know, every kid that wanted
see
to play
that's
sports.
The thing is, I knew who OJ was before OJ.
Right. And people my age that were into football, like you are, would have had a poster of OJ on their wall.
Right.
Nobody had a poster of Casey Anthony on their wall.
I guess Nancy Grace OJ. Fans might.
Yeah. Well, you know, it all comes down to, a lot of the comments on Facebook and elsewhere are people saying, like, this is a travesty.
Yeah.
She should have fried.
Yeah.
And really, I think that a lot of that bullshit comes down to people feeling inadequate in their own lives, so they want to put the government's guns on other people. You know, that's every comment I see of, like, you know, when someone's busted for weed, oh, we should take the gang members and send them to an island and nuke them.
Yeah.
That's the common man feeling no power and wanting to have power.
Well, you see it all the time, especially with people who, you know, watch sort of the mainstream media outlets. I see that, you know, on stories I post on the web, you know, during my job. People make comments where they just have no concept of the court system or innocent until proven guilty or the reasonable doubt thing. People just...
I'm kind of happily surprised that she was acquitted on the murder charge.
Yeah.
And they charged her with lying to the police, which she did. And I think there's some kind of saving face of the jury and of the judge with that... of, like, well, we got to do something.
Yeah,
but I didn't really follow the case that closely, but I did look over the facts as they were reported, and I didn't see beyond a reasonable doubt. I think they should have acquitted her.
Right. And one of the jurors said something I thought was very astute, you know, saying that you have to prove that. If I'm going to convict somebody to something that could lead to the death penalty, then I'm a murderer too. So you have to convince me beyond any kind of doubt if I'm going to have to be a part of somebody's murder. Which I think was really good of a juror to be thinking of. And about the lying to the cops thing, I just ponder on how almost that seems so ridiculous, because cops can lie in the interrogation room.
I know.
And yet you can't. I mean, I thought they're supposed to be the servants, you know, in Fantasyland, which I obviously don't believe in.
You know, part of it too is the CSI effect. It's like people watch these shows and they think that every case should be wrapped up in an hour with compelling right. DNA evidence, which I think is good, man, because a lot of people on death row that were later acquitted with DNA were put there on circumstantial evidence, and they were trying to put Casey Anthony away on circumstantial yeah. evidence. They didn't really have much.
Yeah.
Leading into this next thing, this review of this book, which is about talking to the cops after a shoot, I'll say something that happened to me recently, which was interesting, was I started getting these text messages on my new cell phone, text messages and voice calls from this crazy woman who, like, thought that I was a woman that was cheating on her man with, you know, cheating with her man. And she was like, call, you know, like, is Kelly there? Yeah. Kelly, you stay away from my man. And like,
yeah.
What we finally figured out, we talked to the phone company and read these subliterate text messages. What we finally figured out was somebody was cloning my number. And, oh. you know, basically what I think is happening is this woman, her man is cheating on her with some, or some old girlfriend of his is still trying to get in contact with her and picked a random number to put the return number for her texts and picked mine. And I talked to the phone company about it. I finally paid $5 a month to block the number, which I don't think I should
have
to pay.
$5 a month? Just to block one number?
Yeah, they gave me, no, to block 30 numbers, okay. but to have that service. Okay. And, you know, they gave me 2 months of it for free, and I'm going to probably cancel it after that and see if it's still right. happening. But, I mean, they were calling me at like 3 a.m. and waking me up and stuff. And we talked to the phone company, and they said, well, there are apps out there. They're not ours, but there are third-party apps where you can fake the outgoing phone number.
Huh, I didn't know that.
And I acted like a good statist because I was trying to get this $5 thing free. And I was like, is that legal? And she's like, no. And I looked it up, and it's illegal except for cops. Cops can do it.
Mm. That's how it always works. Rule of law. I mean, cops can do whatever they want.
Speaking of cops using your words against you and phone calls, I read this book. All right, so we got a book review. This time it's a book I've actually read. We usually review books we haven't read. But it's a book called After You Shoot, Your Gun's Hot, Your Perp's Not. Now What?
I do really like the title before we get into the actual book. I really like the title.
By Alan Corwin. There's actually a passage on page 67 that refers negatively to the book You and the Police, which is a book we love by Boston Tea Party. And it says, acting like a real smartass and asking, what is your reasonable articulatable suspicion, officer, as one prolific gun author suggests, is just the sort of attitude that will get you tasered and charged with resisting arrest.
Right.
Which is really weird that he put that in there because it's totally out of context, because that's for what to say at a traffic stop when they want to search your car, not what to say after you shoot somebody in self-defense.
Yeah. I also found it kind of meek because he doesn't actually name, you know, why doesn't he speak Boston's name? Because he feels a little squirrely about what he's saying, I think.
I know. And Boston's had over 100 stops, mostly when he lived in Texas, and has never been tasered or arrested, and he's always pushed the police yeah. or stuff like that. I think a lot of the New Hampshire activism that those guys do and film is based on the book You and the Police. I haven't asked them, but it sure seems like it.
Yeah, I'm sure they've read it. It's probably sort of one of their bedrocks. And about living in Texas, I think the average person who lives in Texas probably gets stopped 100 times, at least, in their yeah. lifetime.
So let's popcorn read this, starting with, I'll read this first paragraph, and then we'll do a paragraph each.
Okay.
I've been a fan of some of Corwin's other writing. I think he does a decent job of summarizing state laws in other books, considering he's a non-lawyer writing law books. But I believe that After You Shoot is a dangerous book to the reader. It's largely based on the premise of, call your lawyer and have him call 911. I believe this could possibly lead to a clean shoot being charged as a homicide because it delays aid to the person shot. I was thinking this throughout the book, and then the lawyers Corwin interviews at the end agreed with my thoughts and disagreed with Corwin on this and several other of Corwin's theories.
Also, when Michael read his suggestion to carry a card in your wallet stating that you want to cooperate but won't talk to police until you talk to a lawyer, Michael thought, this would seem damn wonky and probably work against you. And the lawyers Corwin interviews at the end also agreed with Michael's thought and disagreed with Corwin on this.
Yeah, and kudos to him for putting the chapter in where he has the round table with five attorneys, a private investigator, and a former cop who mostly all disagreed with him.
I was going to mention that. It seems like at the end of all the paragraphs in this book review, you mentioned that all the lawyers, this whole panel disagreed with him. But I'm glad that Corwin put it in there. Maybe that,
I am too.
That was the balance, you know?
And Corwin says over and over that you should ask to speak to my attorney, not an attorney. The difference of this wording of one over the other are not the mystical get-out-of-jail-free magic words Corwin seems to imply they are by constantly stressing the wording. And while Corwin's suggestion to pay for an hour with a lawyer up front to suss him out and see what he's like is a good idea, but it doesn't really make them your lawyer. Only hiring a lawyer truly makes them your lawyer, and then only until the case is settled. You know, lawyers send out a thing when a case is over saying, this is done, I'm no longer your attorney.
Yeah.
And the lawyers Corwin interviewed at the end agreed with my thought on this and disagreed with Corwin. Corwin's suggesting putting down a 10 or 20 grand retainer, which does not even make them your lawyer until you actually hire them, seemed kind of, you know, a good idea, but most people don't have the resources to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I do not have 10 grand to put towards a lawyer. That 10 grand's doing something much better than paying some guy who's got a law degree.
Paying off your college debt so you don't get sold into sex slavery.
Exactly. That's where that money's going to. But regarding Corwin's suggestion to ask potential lawyers this question, which is, quote, if I were in a self-defense shoot, would you call 911 for me? Michael read that and thought, most lawyers would think, so you're planning a homicide and trying to rope me in as cover? And someone in the legal profession that Michael talked to agreed on that. Good for talking to them, Michael. And finally, on page 117, Corwin even brings that fact up, that could, you know, screw you.
Yeah. Corwin is right that it is a travesty that 911 calls are released to the press and used in court, and it's time for real change in that. But when you're facing serious possible charges, is not the time to start working on changing that. A simple traffic stop may be a good time for activism and flexing your rights, but a self-defense shooting is not the time for activism. It's the time to call 911, keep it short and sweet, then shut up until you talk to your lawyer.
Right. When I read this part of the review, I want to divert here a little bit, you know, because I'm not really sure what I do, and I think about that sometimes, you know, as I'm walking late at night with my gun and somebody creepy passes me by. I'm like, you know, what if they did attack me? I had to end up pulling the trigger, you know, which I'm only going to pull if I'm going to pop. That's why I'm living today, you know, in the words of Jay-Z. What would you do, Michael? You would call 911 immediately and say what?
I think I would do what Boston recommends and what Massad Ayoub suggests. And Massad Ayoub was a cop, so he has the cop's insight on it.
Okay, so what is it? I mean, walk me through it. What do you think you'd do?
First of all, Ayoub suggests if you're in a situation where his buddies are going to kill you because you just shot him, get the hell out of there. And as you, you know, drive away or run away, as you do, scream, somebody call 911 or somebody call an ambulance.
Right, right.
Because some witness may hear you say that, you know, you're going to run around the corner and call 911, but someone else may have heard you say that, some good person who will talk to the police in that situation and get you out of trouble.
And then we'll call 911 and there'll be a 911 tape of them saying, somebody's screaming out, call 911, so I'm calling. I just heard gunshots.
You know, one interesting thing I learned about this, about 911 from this book, and it's the only thing I learned about it. I mean, I knew 911 was a recording system.
Yeah.
You know, and his basic premise is, well, you're supposed to remain, be able to remain silent, but you're not because you're making 911 call and it's going to be used in court and released to the press maybe.
Yeah.
I would keep it really short and simple. I'd be like, some guy I don't know just tried to kill me. I shot him in self-defense. I need an ambulance and the police. And I would probably describe myself so they don't roll up and shoot me.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say, I'm the white guy, he's the Arab. No, I'm kidding. I'm the white guy, he's the Mexican or the black guy. No, I'd be like, you know, I'm 5'5", white guy with short blonde hair, 180 pounds. The guy I shot is, you know, 60-ish-year-old white guy who's 6 foot tall and has a beard or whatever, you know. I'd describe him and describe me. I'd holster my gun. I wouldn't have it hanging out. I would comply with the cops. It'd be the one situation I would absolutely, you know, when they say, let me see your hands, put your hands on your head, get on your knees, whatever. They're going to treat you like a suspect. They're going to cuff you, probably. They're going to take you away.
Yeah.
Unless you're in your home in Wyoming, then they might not.
Or Texas.
They still might. Yeah, they still might, but I would absolutely comply with any commands of the cops. I would not say, this is the time to flex my, I don't have to do what you're saying, because they're in fear for their life.
Well, I do worry about the 911 call. I mean, I think we do live in an age where prosecutors are able to take things out of context and use them as circumstantial evidence. I mean, we did see the jury use the reasonable doubt thing well in the Casey Anthony trial, but that doesn't happen everywhere. And people are calling for her blood. You know, if I somehow made some little mental slip in my 911 call, which I'm obviously going to be panicked and I'm not going to be, I mean, I'm going to be all there, but I'm going to be in under stress, under mental stress. And so you could make some kind of mistake.
I would probably ask for an ambulance first. I'd say, you know.
Okay. To show that you have concern for the victim. Somebody's been shot. They need medical attention.
And not just to show it, but to have it.
Yeah,
to be a decent human being. It's like a self-defense shooting is not to try to kill somebody.
It's
sometimes
to stop
it does.
Them. It's to stop them.
But it's to stop them. Yeah. And when they're down and you've kicked their knife or gun away from their hand, you know, and I would, if I were going to leave the scene, like if people were coming after me to kill me, I'd take his weapon because they're going to take it. And then there's no proof that there's a weapon unless there was a camera there.
Right.
But I'd kick the weapon away from him. Boston recommends stepping on his wrist and then kicking it away because when your wrist is stepped on, you can't grab anything. But yeah, I'd ask for an ambulance. I would probably not render first aid because the guy could jump up and try to choke me or something.
Right.
But the only thing I learned from this book, which I didn't know, which is good to know, is that 911 has the capacity to remotely disable your phone from making other calls after you call them until they unlock it.
That really scared me too when I read about that. Yeah, that is not something I want to have happen. But then again, when I gave it a second thought, I was like, well, they record all that anyway. They could subpoena my phone records and hear anybody I'm calling anyway.
They probably do that to keep you from hiding evidence or getting a story straight with someone else. But you're not going to be able to call your lawyer or your wife probably after you make the call if they lock it up.
But then if you call your lawyer or your wife first, then you have to answer about that in court because they're going to subpoena your phone records.
Well, what I would do is call the police and ambulance. Call 911, ask for an ambulance, and the police say I've been in a self-defense shooting. And then I'd hang up and call my wife or my lawyer. You know, if I'm with my wife, I'd call my lawyer. But I'd probably have to use her phone if they lock mine up. But they might lock both of them because they're on a friends and family plan. I don't know if they can lock both of them.
I hope not. But is this a national thing? I mean, obviously, it seems like it'd be different everywhere. I mean, it seems like your phone gets locked if you live in a place like San Francisco, but maybe not if you live in a place like Casper.
Maybe. Some places don't even have 911. It's not everywhere. It's like 90-some percent of places. But, you know, interesting thing I learned about GPS, too. They can tell, you know, where you are from phone GPS, but they can't tell what your altitude is. So if you're in an office building on the 20th floor, they don't know if you're on the 20th floor or in the lobby.
Huh, I did not know that either.
So if you ever have to get 911 there and you're in a building, tell them what floor you're on.
Okay. Or don't, depending on your needs.
We don't recommend breaking any
laws. Oh, I forgot.
But yeah. Yeah. But anyway, I think Corwin's book is bad. I don't usually write bad reviews of books because I know what it takes to write a book as an author, but I'm going to make an exception because I think this book is dangerous to the reader. I think Corwin should stick to activism and summarizing existing laws rather than endangering people by suggesting needed changes in laws as what they should actually try to do when they may be facing life in prison or a lethal injection.
Right, but at least he had a chapter where lawyers disagreed with him and he included
which
that. So
was cool of him. Yeah, and one prominent gun writer I know who won't be named doesn't like the idea of this book either. You know, there's no magic words. There's no magic words for cops. The only magic words are I have nothing to say, I want to talk to an attorney.
Right.
I was watching News Radio recently. You know that show?
I do know that show. Phil Hartman was in it, wasn't he? And
yeah,
Phil Hartman
is
amazing.
I recently watched all the episodes.
Okay.
All the ones up to where Phil Hartman was killed and by his wife and replaced by John Lovitz. I don't like those episodes. But there's a really funny thing in there where Jimmy James, the billionaire who runs the company, who actually also does the voice of Bill Dauterive on King of the Hill.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Same actor. Okay. But he goes into small claims court because someone screwed him and sold him a bunch of fake movie props. And his counsel is Joe the Electrician, who's played by, what's his name? He's a libertarian in real life. You know, the guy that did
Drew Carey?
No. The kind of tough guy.
Joe Rogan. Yeah.
He acts as the attorney for his boss in this. He said that all judges, federal, state, and local, are members of a small sect of the Freemasons. And there's a word that you can tell them and they have to rule in your favor. And the word is Duplicane. And at the end, you know, Jimmy James is about to get screwed in this court thing. And Joe says, Dubal Cain, and all of a sudden the judge rules in his case. But there's no Dubal Cain, man. There's no magic
words. There's no Dubal Cain. That also reminds me of 30 Rock, when there's, you know, Alec Baldwin's supposed to have been in the Skull and Bones or some secret organization.
Yeah.
And there's the secret thing that makes him have to say something and turn around and walk out of the room.
Yeah. Why is it that I like workplace comedies that take place in television stations? There's like four of them that I like, and I don't even work in it. Do you like them?
Oh, yeah. I love 30 Rock. I did like news radio when it was on. Obviously, that was before I worked in media, but I did like it. When I was a kid, I loved Murphy Brown for some reason. I haven't seen it in probably two decades, but when I was very, very young, I watched it and liked it. What else? What else do we watch that's...
Sunset Strip, Studio.
Never saw that, but
60 on the Sunset Strip, and that one, Sports Talk or Sports.
No, I haven't seen that.
It was by the same guy. I recommended
either.
That to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I haven't seen those yet. I mean, we haven't seen them on Hulu. We don't have Netflix. You have the Netflix. We have the Hulu. We don't.
You should get the Netflix. So Washington State is using bomb sniffing dogs to prevent firecrackers from coming in on ferries.
I did see that. Yeah, I thought it was hilarious how the guy took exception to how ridiculous it is to spend thousands of dollars of tax money to have the cops search people on ferries for freaking fireworks. I mean, really, that's the point we're at. Also, I'd like to point out the irony of these kind of tyrannies and little nanny state things on the 4th of July, which, I mean, I don't buy into the whole mythology necessarily, but that's what it's supposed to ostensibly be, is a celebration of freedom. You know, we actually are a nice little microcosm here where I live. I live in the Tri-Cities, Washington. They call it the Tri-Cities, you know, because there's three cities about the same size, Richland, Kennewick, and Pasco. And two of them ban fireworks, and one of them doesn't. It's a big hullabaloo, you know, among lots of the people in the media market. You know, they say, oh, there's this many fires, and Richland is the only people who haven't banned it. And they always talk about that. But we get the same amount of fires in each of the cities. Doesn't matter what kind of law you write. It's fireworks. People are going to do fireworks on the 4th of July no matter what.
Wyoming is very friendly to fireworks. You can't do it in big cities. But when you come in from Utah, when you cross the border, immediately the first thing you see are three fireworks stores, an adult porno bookshop, and a bunch of liquor stores.
Well, that's the border.
People go from Utah
to
get all that stuff.
Because that's the border between Utah and Wyoming. So that's sort of the make a run to the border. And that's the border town. That's like the Nuevo Laredo between Utah and Wyoming.
Did you ever see that movie Salt Lake City Punk?
Yes, I love that movie.
There's a scene in there where they're going to Wyoming to buy booze.
To get real beer, because the beer in Utah is half the alcohol of the beer in other places. 3-2.
Yeah. Which is weird. It's like, ban it or don't.
Yeah.
Don't just make it shitty.
Yeah. You know? In fact, in SLC Punk, I think he says, you know, then you just get the worst kind of drunk. The drunk that has to drink twice the amount of beer and gets fat and sloppy.
And you have to pee a lot. Yeah. But the people that work at the store there are characters of Wyoming rednecks with shotguns. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice.
Maybe I'll link that.
The thing about Utah is they have a state-run liquor monopoly, too. You can buy the 3-2 beer in grocery stores, but to get anything bigger than that, you have to go to a state-run building. I mean, it just seems so Soviet.
And, you know, I've played there. Restaurants there serve liquor in airplane bottles, the little one-ounce bottles.
Not only that, and I know that things have gotten even more strict, but a couple times when I've drank in bars, which are private clubs in Utah because you can't really have a bar, so you have a private club that you can buy a temporary membership to, they won't serve you a double of a drink. One of the things I drink is I drink a double of whiskey. They wouldn't give me one. They said you can order two singles, but you can't order a double. So I ordered two singles and poured them in the same glass and set it down and looked at him ironically, and he just sort of shrugged his shoulders like, I know, it's ridiculous.
See, he keeps you right with God, man.
Yeah, we'll see. In Washington State, actually, another reason where we're probably really low on the list of states as far as freedom goes, we also have a liquor monopoly here. We have state-run liquor monopoly. I've probably talked about that in the podcast before, but it does still really annoy me.
So there's a bunch of stuff. We got a few minutes left that I'm just going to read headlines for a second. Plaxico Burress teams with Brady campaign for anti-gun crap.
Ugh, are you serious?
What a pussy, man.
I even wrote I never put it out, but I had a song I wrote and recorded where I mentioned Plaxico just because I thought it was ridiculous that he was in jail for carrying a gun. I mean, he shot himself. That should be punishment enough.
And now he's an expert on why people shouldn't have guns because he shot himself.
You know who else is like that too? T.I. I mean, hasn't T.I. been telling people not to
I've
go
seen
get
him.
Guns?
I've seen him on MTV telling kids not to play with guns or never get a gun even when you grow up.
I mean, what do they do? Do the prosecutors cut? Is this some kind of deal they cut since they're celebrities? We'll throw you in jail. Yeah. We'll let you get out a few months early if you go PSA and shill for our tyranny.
I wouldn't do it.
I wouldn't do it either. In fact, it really upset me that Lil Wayne went to jail. as powerful, as rich as he is, I would have fought that. I would have brought that to the Supreme Court. I would have moved to Switzerland and fought it from there. I would not have gone to jail. I would not have turned myself in. I would have fought that.
So did you read about the Wisconsin judge choking another judge over the union bill in chambers?
No. Please do tell.
That's enough. That's all the time we got for that one, okay. But it happened. I'll link
all right,
it.
And now, the NEMA News with Nima Vedati.
And now for your daily dose of nanny statism in our daily segment, Tyranny Today.
Tyranny Today.
$500 ticket issued for illegal lemonade stand. Little girls that were raising money for cancer research with a lemonade stand got a $500 ticket.
I was hoping we wouldn't get one of those this summer. We've gotten them the past two summers. I've seen those nationally, and it makes everybody sick. There's not one person who reads a story like that.
You'd think that goons would have some sense of, like, spin, you know?
Yeah, you'd think.
Beating up little girls with $500 and raising money for cancer, yeah, okay? Yeah.
They probably have a sense of it. I think it's at this point, they just don't care anymore. They can't resist. Yeah. The temptation to be nannies is too strong for them to actually care about their public image anymore. They've gone off the deep end.
So let's see. Man jailed for growing marijuana for cancer-stricken wife. I'll link that. Talk about this guy that was shot by the police.
Okay. This is one that really made me go, wow, this is insane. Guy, a West Point graduate, carries a gun concealed, you know, everyday thing. Yeah, it was in Las Vegas, in a Las Vegas Costco. Legally carrying, has his permit, you know, abiding by all the laws, which, I mean, obviously I don't feel there should be because we have the Second Amendment. But doing everything by the book, bends over to pick up a case of some drink. And because he's carrying in the small of his back, an employee walks by and sees, you know, the handle of his gun sticking out. Tells the security guard. Security guard goes and tells him, you know, you can't have the gun here. He says, I got the permit. I'm carrying legally. I didn't see a sign. I'm fine. I'm following all the laws, all the rules. Security guard calls the cops. Cops come in. There's a confrontation. The guy's got his arms up. He's saying, yeah, I'm legal. You know, I don't know what you want me to do.
They told him to drop his gun.
They told him like three different things.
They gave him conflicting reports. They said, keep your hands above your head. Don't put them down. And then they said, drop your gun, which was on his hip.
Right. So which does he do? Yeah.
I would have said, not that he did anything wrong, but I would have said, I can't do both, officer. What do you want me to do? Or I'd probably say, I'm keeping my hands up. I'm giving you permission to take my gun out.
That might have helped. But I think it was different officers, too. Wasn't he getting orders from different officers at the same time? Shot him. And it was a cop who took the first shot, they believe, had previously had another officer involved shooting, had shot somebody else. When I read that, I'm thinking, you know, I do this all day, every day. I'm carrying at 3:30, 3:15, you know, not in the small of my back, but in that same area. If I bent over, there's a chance that my shirt could pull up over and show my handle. There's a chance that could happen to any of us who carry every day.
I think it'd be less likely to happen in Wyoming than in Vegas, but it wouldn't be impossible.
I don't think it would happen in Wyoming, but, you know, you could be somewhere else. There's places that accept Wyoming's concealed carry. You could be in Texas. You could be in a bigger city in Texas that might do that. And when I read this, it made me feel like maybe this cop just, I mean, I don't like to hate on cops, but since this cop has a history of it, and I don't know what happened again, I wasn't there. But I just got the sense that he just saw an opportunity and he took it. He got some kind of pleasure or just had some kind of trigger itch that he had to scratch and saw an opportunity to do that. And it just made me sick to my stomach. Again, I wasn't there. I don't want to indict anybody without having seen it with my own eyes, but that's the feeling I got.
It's fucking horrible.
Yeah, it really is. We end on a bad note on that, man. You gotta bring us back into the sunshine, Michael.
All right.
Freedom Fix.
Freedom Fix.
Devin the Dude Live, man. I got the Devin the Dude Live DVD from Netflix, and it's pretty good.
I haven't seen it.
I like Devin the Dude.
I love.
It's basically concert footage of a show at a club in Houston. Okay. I didn't really like that much. It really didn't transfer. You know, it didn't.
You gotta be at a Devin the Dude concert to really feel it, because when you're at a Devin concert, there's like 50 blunts being passed around by everybody's got their own blunt, pretty much. They pass it out like an Indian cigar box.
But his music videos are interspersed within it, and they're really good, and they're funny.
Yeah.
And he's an older dude, isn't he? Like 40 or something, and he's been doing.
Yeah,
it forever,
he's been around for a while, a long time. He's been doing it. Everybody probably knows him from an album as old as The Chronic. He was on one of Dr. Dre's songs in The Chronic 2000,
yeah.
Which is, you know, obviously a long time ago. But he's been doing his thing for well before that. Devin's been around for a while.
I liked his video Doobie Ashtray.
Oh, yes, that is a great
song. And it's cool because it kind of shows the progression of technology in music, which we've been talking about a lot. Like, it shows him as a kid dumpster diving outside the radio station to get the warped records they threw away, and then taking him home and like kids chasing him because they saw him in the dumpster and laughing at him. And then he's like at home in his house listening to the records of, you know, like Curtis Blow, and like they show him running with one of the records. It's a Sly and the Family Stone record, which is stuff I liked as a kid and still do like. You know, it shows him, this is something I haven't thought about for 30 years or 20 years, putting a penny on the tone arm so you can play a warped record.
Yeah.
You know, putting a penny or a nickel to give it more weight. It's bad for the record, but, you know, a record that's warped, it'll skip. You could keep it from skipping by putting a penny or a nickel on the tone
arm. Devin's really good about that. Devin is amazing and famous, but he hasn't lost touch with the common man.
Yeah, he seemed really humble. And there's this really funny running joke throughout the thing. It shows him in the studio calling some music store, like Guitar Center
asking
or something.
Asking for the boom. Did they play that in the movie?
Asking for the boom. Yes.
I need a boom. And
it's hilarious.
Yeah, he does it in his
man.
White country guy voice, which is great. He's like, somebody said it's a 008 or 800 or something like that. Make a trunk bang, make a trunk rattle. Boom.
Yeah, and like the guy at the music store is just like, put you on hold and let you talk to someone else. And they just keep passing him off to people, and nobody knows what he's talking about.
I need a boom. There's 72 bars out here.
I need 72 booms. It's funny. Because if you know anything about computer music production, it's like, no, you only need one and you paste it in 72 times.
Right.
But he's like, I need 72. Can you send a truck over? I need 72 booms. Can you deliver them?
He goes,
deliver them. I can't leave the studio.
Can you deliver a boom, Tyrus? I need a boom.
So there's the good note we're ending on.
It's Devin the Dude. Go listen to Devin. There's also, I mean, he even tackles inflation, you know, which is something our listeners probably would want to hear. Devin the Dude, he's got a song called Almighty Dollar, written in like 2008, but just addresses the fact that he says, hobos used to ask you for a dollar, now the mother effers ask you for three, which is true.
Yeah. All right, man.
All right. Freedom Fiends, we out.
Been a good cast. Freedom Fiends, out.
Peace.
Peace. Worms.
Hello, Freedom Fiends. It's your boy, Dean. From the U.S., get the U.S. out my bloodstream. I owe me and that include endorphins. No one won't ask permission and I won't say please. Freedom fans, one fact that I gotta make clear.
The Freedom Fiends podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Do what you want with it and spread it around. Tell two friends. Make copies. Email it to everyone you know. Go on the site and comment. This is a conversation. Every Friday night, we'll have an exciting new episode where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi weave their own unique take on the way the world works and how to find your place in it. Available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com. Subscribe and tell two friends.
And remember, the only power they have is the power you allow them.